Good afternoon, everyone. Council, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Pleasure to appear before you. Brian Sullivan of Warbin Sullivan for the appellants. Anthony Horvell and Herc Management Services, LLC, derivatively and on behalf of Seagrid Corporation. And I would like to introduce to the court Mr. Michael Collins of the Brewer Law Firm of Dallas, Texas, and also New York. Mr. Collins has had the pleasure of appearing before this court several times before, and also the Court of Chancery on a number of occasions. May it please the court.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor. And his motion pro hoc vice, the order has been entered. Thank you.
May it please the court, Michael Collins of Brewer Attorneys and Counselors for Appellants. We respectfully submit that the final judgment of the Court of Chancery should be reversed and remanded for further proceedings for two reasons. One, we believe the determination that the claims asserted in this derivative action by appellants are barred by the doctrine of collateral estoppel is an error of law. Two, with respect to the issue of a double derivative action, it appeared to us that was, if that was the only issue, that was probably going to be dismissed without prejudice with the right to replead, and that either it would be a new action or dismissed without prejudice so we could file a new action or to amend the existing action. My focus, since the collateral estoppel issue was the reason for the dismissal with prejudice, I'm going to start off by focusing on the collateral estoppel issue. There's certain common ground among the parties. One is that federal law governs whether collateral estoppel should be applied to the claims asserted in this case because the prior proceeding, the prior final judgment, was entered by a United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Delaware. So there's no dispute about that. Where we find the federal law, whether it's federal common law or we call it federal law, there are established standards to look to. I think it's also common ground that with respect to your standard of review for purposes of that decision, dismissing with prejudice our claims or appellant's claims based on the doctrine of collateral estoppel, that it's de novo. The application of collateral estoppel should be reviewed de novo without deference to the decision of the Court of Chancery, which we respect. We respectfully disagree, but we respect it. So, bottom line, where do we think the Court of Chancery erred? The focus of our argument is on one element of the for collateral estoppel. There's one actually litigated, which I'll get to. But under federal law, we cite Third Circuit. I think we cited United States Supreme Court. So I don't think there's any dispute that under federal law, the applicable federal law here, that the determination by the bankruptcy court must have been necessary for its decision. Other courts use the word essential. That the outcome, the Supreme Court has said, the outcome must have hinged on it. So we believe that gives context to how we look at what the bankruptcy court did. So, for example, Your Honors, the Court of Chancery looked at paragraph 35 of the, what I'll refer to as the confirmation order, the order confirming the plan. It did some other things besides that, but what it also did was confirm the plan. It looked to paragraph 35. And what the court said was one of the grounds for its decision is, well, we look at paragraph 34, and it provides for the allowance of Giant Eagle's claims against the debtor. So therefore, I think that that is collateral estoppel on any affirmative claims by the derivative plaintiff on behalf of the company in this action. One, we have a procedural objection to that, but more importantly, we have a substantive. But procedurally, that was not raised by appellees. It was raised by the Court of Chancery after the parties submitted their written briefs, after oral argument, during the Court's decision, the Court of Chancery's noted paragraph 35. So let's put that procedural issue to the side. Someone could say that's possibly harmless error, but let's get to the substance of it. It's wrong for a very fundamental reason. And we go back to whether it was necessary to the decision, essential, did the outcome hinge on it? It didn't, because there was no objection to Giant Eagle's claims. Under the bankruptcy rules, including Rule 3001F, a proof of claim is prima facie evidence of the validity of the claim. Unless someone comes in to challenge the claim is allowed. We did not challenge that claim. The debtor did not challenge that claim. We think for obvious reasons, but we don't have to get into that. No other party in interest challenged that claim. So its determination that it was allowed was not necessary decision. It wasn't actually litigated at all. The appellees will mention that we did commence an adversary proceeding, my clients did, to equitably subordinate Giant Eagle's claims.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, we did. Absolutely did, Your Honor.
And you would equitably subordinate them because they were to be equitably subordinated is a bankruptcy term to basically disregard somebody's obligation because it's the product of some sort of illegal or inequitable conduct that results in a justification for the court subordinating it to other people who should have higher claims because of that, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. It may result in an absolute disallowance. Usually it may result
into... Exactly, and it did not result in that. And
right.
In fact, it resulted in the approval of the plan and the allowance of Giant not subordinating them and references to good faith and the approval of the plan, which you then collaterally attacked in the Court of Chancery as the latest step in Giant Eagle's, you know, fraud.
Right. Well, Your Honor, we did dismiss without prejudice, with the bankruptcy court's permission, that equitable subordination action. It did not go forward. It was supposed to go forward at the same time as the confirmation hearing. Being candid with the court, we didn't like that dynamic. We didn't think that maximized our prospects. So we dismissed without prejudice, and we're allowed to dismiss without prejudice.
But you're focusing now on paragraph 35, and it seems to me you ought to put your real focus on paragraph 15, which is the heart of the good faith determination.
Absolutely, and I will switch to that now. Let's go back to how do you determine whether something was necessary, essential to the decision in the prior case, whether the outcome hinged on it. We respectfully submit you do that by looking at the applicable legal standards. What did the bankruptcy court have to do to confirm that plan? Not what it said, because that could be dicta. Not what he intended necessarily, because that could be dicta. It's take the legal elements that are required to confirm that plan, and then go down to see what he or she said, and here was a he, about each of those elements. Okay, 1129 of the Bankruptcy Code, 11 U.S.C. 1129, has the mandatory requirements for confirmation of a plan. The one at issue here is 1129A3. That requires a plan to be proposed in good faith. That's the plain language of 1129A3, whether the plan itself was proposed in good faith and achieves an objective consistent with the policies and purposes of the Bankruptcy Code. We have cited Third Circuit authority that would have governed the Bankruptcy Court. Same standards.
But if the plan had been proposed as part of a breach of fiduciary duty, it would not have been proposed in good faith, right?
Well, you go to, Your Honor, no, proposed in good faith and not by any means forbidden by law. That's the second part.
Well, let's just look at your theory here. Your theory is this plan was part of a Machiavellian plot to defraud your client. Therefore, the plan should not be approved. The bankruptcy court looked at that carefully with your help. Said, no, I don't think it's part of this Machiavellian plot. I think it's a good faith plan. I'm approving it. And now we're trying to parse what was good faith, the proposal of the plan or the plan itself. But my question is, didn't the court look at your allegation that this was part of a Machiavellian plot and approved the plan anyway?
We don't think so, Your Honor, for several important reasons.
But didn't you want them to do that? Weren't you alleging the plan was part of the plot?
We, in our written objection, now let's go back to first the written objection that was filed to confirmation of the plan. There's some general language to it, but if you go to that written objection under 1129A3, the emphasis is other aspects of the plan, about buying votes of other creditors, about failure of disclosure. Now, there was, I think it was maybe a total of a page over two pages. But that wasn't the only focus of the objection. Now, we did attach to the objection the complaint in the Pittsburgh action and the complaint in this action. But if you look at the actual objection, the written objection that was filed under 1129A3, Your Honor, that wasn't the focus of it. Two.
Well, then let me ask the question differently. If the bankruptcy court thought this plan was part of a Machiavellian plot, would it have approved the plan?
Whether he would have or whether he could have, whether he would have, I think that's a difficult decision to get into, whether what he would have done or not. But I think it's more important, and we respectfully submit, is whether he could have. Yes, it's the actual plan that's proposed. Was that in good faith? And if you look at the transcript of his ruling, really what he's saying is, I'm looking at what we're at January 2015. This is the best of a bad situation. There's nothing else available. There's no lenders. There's no investors. At least everybody has a shot. Otherwise, this goes into Chapter 7. So sitting here today, this plan is proposed in good faith. Now, they want to contend, appellees, that we litigated this whole issue of this grand conspiracy. Your Honor, we tried our best not to. Why? Because it wasn't in our best interest to litigate that then. We didn't think we had all the discovery, for example, we would want to actually go after that issue. We made a strategic choice not to. So, for example, Your Honor, when they were going through...
Who was the debtor?
Secret Corporation.
The old Secret?
Old Secret, yes, Your Honor.
And the bankruptcy court gave all rights to claims of old Secret to new Secret, right?
Well, it's a little ambiguous because there's two different provisions, but that's certainly one thing that could be interpreted to happen. Yes.
It says absolutely. All cause of action.
Right. But there's also a conflicting provision, I think, in the actual confirmation order. I mean, actually in the plan. The plan and the confirmation order conflict a little bit, but that's not, I don't think, material. Because, Your Honor, you look at what was disclosed to the bankruptcy court about what it was doing as far as doing that. He was very clear at several times about, I'm not here to try to affect other litigation. Now, the focus was on Pittsburgh at that time, but the court does make statements about, I'm not trying to affect that. Now, I may affect it because I have to affect it. They'll bring up that point to you during the hearing on our motion to dismiss without prejudice our equitable subordination action, but he was trying to be careful not to do that.
I read that portion of the transcript completely differently. I read it as, you've been warned, I'm going to let you dismiss without prejudice, but you've been warned that findings I may make on plan confirmation or down the line or may have collateral estoppel effect. That's the way I read that. And both the Allegheny County and the Delaware complaints were referred in those passages.
Well, Your Honor, that's the one they refer to. I go to the transcript on January 15th. They refer to the transcript on January 12th, if I may. But that's not necessarily a typical finding that I would make in the context of a plan confirmation. I don't believe the debtor needs it. And again, I'm aware of the shadow of separate litigation and it's not my intention to affect that one way or the other. So, for example, they wanted a finding, Your Honor, that Giant Eagle did not exercise control or otherwise exert improper influence over the debtor or and its board, or in any way conspire with the debtor's board to the detriment of any debtor stakeholders. They allege that we said that in our written objection to confirmation of the plan, so therefore it should go in. Our counsel, Your Honor, Mr. Nelligan, Patrick Nelligan. Your Honor, first, we withdrew any objection to or claim against Giant Eagle for exercising improper control, but, or you know, bad faith. We did not want that as part of the confirmation hearing. The court, yeah, I'm going to strike that. So, Your Honor, that we think is important evidence to the extent it's a matter of the intent of the bankruptcy court, is what he was really trying to do here.
So by that, how can your client, I don't understand how you can then plead in Delaware that the bankruptcy plan itself is the latest step towards stealing the company, and how it is you can assert causes of action that now belong under the plan to the new entity and were assigned by it?
Well, Your Honor,
assigned
one
to
is,
it.
I apologize.
No, that's my fault. But.
Okay. One is, I say we think there's an ambiguity there.
I don't see it, and if you want to identify what it is, it gives everything that belongs to the debtor to the new entity. The new entity is under a new approved capital structure. It's approved by a federal bankruptcy court, and you want to come into the Court of Chancery and say, frankly, the latest step in the coup de grace in what Justice Holland was referring to is the bankruptcy plan itself. Okay. And Court of Chancery, you undo all this. Start by letting people who don't have control over a claim proceed. Then let them challenge this and, in fact, prove that this plan itself was in bad faith.
Your Honor, with respect to the plan, and I'll be, as always, very candid with the court, would I amend our complaint if we get this reversed on collateral estoppel to, again, make sure that we were within the confines? I think as far as the actual plan itself, Your Honor, I must agree with you, that allegation may be barred by collateral estoppel, that allegation. But to say the claims are barred, Your Honor, again, that is part of our argument here, is when you apply collateral estoppel, it's not an all-or-nothing thing like res judicata or claim preclusion. What you alleged or could have alleged. You can't use a broad brush approach.
So is your new claim a claim against New Seagrid for failing to pursue the derivative claim? Or is it your original claim that you intended to assert as a derivatively on behalf of Old Seagrid?
It originally started out as a derivative claim against Old Seagrid.
What's your new claim?
Okay. New claim would be the same factual basis as revised, but one way of looking at it, it's now a double derivative claim given the corporate transaction that happened in connection with confirmation of the plan.
I thought the whole reason they wanted to substitute parties was so that New Seagrid could get control of the litigation and make a decision whether to pursue it or not, and then you'd have your remedies whether to take action against New Seagrid for either pursuing or not pursuing the action.
That was the relief they requested, and we objected to that relief, saying at most it should be substituted as a nominal plaintiff, not the plaintiff, was our objection originally. And then the collateral estoppel issue comes up in the reply, and the Court of Chancery gave us an opportunity to file a surreply. But originally the issue was we thought of a double derivative, that it's now at the parent level, so therefore we can assert a double derivative if we can.
And then and what is your, after the restructuring, just remind me of what your client's interest is in New Seagrid?
We have, in New Seagrid, it's through New Seagrid, I think it's about a 7% interest.
Your client?
Yeah, our clients still have equity ownership in New Seagrid, that owns 47% of Old Seagrid. And if you look at the common directorships and officers and two of the other shareholders that own the remaining percentage of New Seagrid, we believe that you will see that in essence, Giant Eagle slash Old Secret have, in essence, majority control. So therefore, even if majority control is required for double derivative action, we think we have that.
But you would have to, per Justice Seitz's thing, you'd have to read the plan as contemplating a derivative action brought by people who are now stock. Were you a stockholder of New Secret before?
Was created under the plan.
How would you have standing as a derivative plaintiff?
Okay. We had standing for Old Secret, no dispute about that. The New Secret's created under a plan. Therefore, we think.
And the capital structure is understood, right? By the bankruptcy court?
I'm sure it was, yes. Very bright man.
Right, but you're then seeking to substitute yourself. If you were going to bring this, you would essentially supplant the folks who controlled New Secret under the plan.
Well, again, if the plan is read to override Delaware law on derivative actions, which we don't think it is, there was never any disclosure made to the bankruptcy court of that's what's going to happen here, that once you confirm this plan, the derivative action goes away. So there was never any evidence or argument to the court.
Actually, under Delaware law, there are a lot of things like mergers and other things that where plans go away that are derivative.
Yes, absolutely.
And you would be trying to then argue that the Delaware Court of Chancery should establish some sort of exception to the contemporaneous ownership thing on the grounds that if a new entity is created in bankruptcy as a result of the plan, then any stockholders in the old entity who got equity were essentially continuing holders and then would maintain derivative status.
Yes, and we think under the prevailing precedent of this court that we would satisfy that standard. There's an issue about majority control or less majority at the parent level, but
the whole idea of settling the plan wouldn't have much effect, would it, to quiet the royal waters of the troubled company under the thing? Because you basically would just continue the fight about the capital structure in a different form.
Well, I guess we'd be seeking damages is one thing we'd be seeking on behalf of the company in this action.
Well, people put in new money in this plan, right?
Giant Eagle, which we can contend is the bad actor, and of course,
right. And so what you're saying is they put in money pursuant to a confirmed plan, which you would like to essentially divest them of the fruits of that benefit, correct?
Absolutely not. If they're not liable, they won't pay a dime. I guess they'll have attorney's fees.
You seek to hold them liable.
Yes, we do. Absolutely, we do.
You seek to say whatever they put in this plan, no matter the confirmation, it's because of their prior misconduct, they should, they get bupkis for that, to use the technical term.
Well, they could have settled it in the plan, the derivative action. They could have disclosed that we're in the disclosure statement that we're settling the derivative action.
Why does it make sense for the law? I mean, I kind of read the judge the same way as Justice Sykes. You all punked out. You caused a lot of inconvenience, and then you ran away.
No, we still fought.
How's that help you?
Well, we did fight confirmation on certain issues, such as feasibility, which we thought was a very strong point we disagreed with, and that's how it works sometimes. But we did fight the plan on feasibility. Yes, we did make a choice that this isn't the best forum to bring up our conspiracy allegations and such, and we respectfully submit it's a choice we can make. And if we look at the actual,
you triangulated choices.
Yes, we did to a certain extent. Yes, we tried to find what was the best strategy for our client.
And that's a good system for trouble company resolution, right?
Well, it's, again, I guess it comes out to is everything should be on the table. And if somebody wants to resolve.
Tables,
right. No, but I'm saying it was a very easy mechanism for to try to get rid of the derivative action. It was to compromise it and settle it and give notice to parties in interest and give them the opportunity to object and to give notice to the bankruptcy court that that's what we're asking you to do. There is, actually, when you look at the settlement of the confirmation order, there's some discussion about settlements in the plan.
I'm trying to figure out what the bankruptcy order would have effectively done other than provisionally say, this is the way New Secret's finances are. New Secret has the assets of Old Secret. But it can all be undone by, I guess at your election, either Allegheny County because you want one of those big sandwiches with the french fries with the meat on it from, or you want a cheesesteak in Delaware, depending on your mood for
you know, great junk food from our region, that's what you would choose, right?
Well, Pittsburgh is just damages against Giant Eagle. It doesn't involve the debtor. But Pittsburgh, Delaware, Chancery, yes, there's the damage would go back into the company
the
from Giant Eagle.
Yeah, just against Giant Eagle, but for their conduct in controlling the debtor.
That's fair. Absolutely. Yes, of course. Absolutely is. That's what we'd be trying to do. Absolutely is. But, again, if they wanted to preempt that, they could have, again, tried to resolve that in the bankruptcy. They could have tried to settle it, and we could have the opportunity to object, and the bankruptcy court would have had full disclosure. But if we look at the applicable legal standards against what actually happened here, we respectfully submit that the determination that this plan was proposed in good faith under 1129A3 doesn't get them where they want to be. And oftentimes, derivative actions do go forward after confirmation of a plan. They do happen. It does happen. And when people don't want it to happen, they negotiate it or they file a motion with the bankruptcy court. So there is that mechanism there. Everyone takes, you know, risk and everyone takes benefits from it. And they all make strategic choices. They make strategic choices. Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Nackbar. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kenneth Nackbar here on behalf of the defendants. Plaintiffs, which I'll refer to as the Horrible Group, were minority stockholders of Seagrid Corporation and creditors. Seagrid is a company that designs and manufactures vision-guided automated vehicles. And those are essentially forklifts and similar equipment that can operate in factories and warehouses without wires, tape, GPS, or other guidance systems. Historically, Seagrid was funded 80% by Giant Eagle, its majority stockholder, 20% by the Horrible Group, and Mr. Horrible was the CEO of the company.
Are these sort of like land drones?
They don't fly. They're on the ground.
Land drones.
Yeah, so, but they're not remote controlled. They actually teach themselves and learn. It's very cool technology. Whether it will be perfected and commercialized in a successful way remains to be seen, but I think they've made strides. I'm sorry?
Do they give them lines to say?
I don't think they talk. I think
good morning,
they,
Joe. Or, you know,
I think they just carry equipment.
It's Friday. You know,
in any event, in July 2014, Mr. Horrible was terminated as CEO of Seagrid, and the Horrible Group, actually prior to that, had declined to participate for whatever reason in further financing. With existing loans coming due, Giant Eagle proposed to fund the company with the proviso that the existing debt holders, principally Giant Eagle and the Horrible Group, would extend the maturities of certain existing loans for 5 years. Mr. Horrible refused, precipitating a liquidity crisis. Knowing that his actions had brought Seagrid to the brink of bankruptcy, Horrible filed a lawsuit in the Court of Chancery on August 8, 2014, derivatively on behalf of Seagrid, asserting that, as Justice Holland indicated, this was all part of a devious plan. That's an exact quote. And Giant Eagle had deliberately starved Seagrid of capital so that it could acquire the company for itself. It was a malicious scheme, a well-orchestrated plot, words like that. Defendants moved to dismiss the complaint. Before that got briefed, the bankruptcy ensued. The Horrible Group, as Your Honors know, filed an equitable subordination claim in the bankruptcy court, and Your Honors are obviously familiar with that. Horrible was the sole objector to the bankruptcy plan. He filed an objection to the disclosure statement, which I'll talk about in a moment, and an objection to various aspects of the plan and post-petition financing, including an assertion of bad faith by Giant Eagle and its directors. The court held a 4-day trial on the Horrible Group's objections. It heard from 12 witnesses. On the morning of trial, however, the Horrible Group, for the tactical reasons you've heard about, decided to withdraw its equitable subordination claim. It's not that they didn't get the discovery they wanted. It's that they didn't get the evidence that they wanted. They couldn't prove their claims, so they decided to do a tactical retreat. The court allowed them to do that. But as Your Honors noted, said, you know, there might be consequences down the road. And I'll get to that specific language in a bit. It did not, however, importantly, it did not withdraw its objections to the disclosure statement. Now, those objections asserted the identical claims as the Horrible Group asserted in the derivative claims in Chancery. Specifically, the Horrible Group asserted that the disclosure statement, and I quote, includes an extensive one-sided diatribe that blames Mr. Horrible and Herc for all the debtor's ills, including but not limited to the debtor's need to file its bankruptcy case. That's at page B39, B40 in the record. His objection continued. There is, however, an extensive set of facts known to the debtor that contradicts the narrative included by debtor in its disclosure statement. Those facts can be found in two lawsuits that members of the Horrible Group filed against Giant Eagle and members of the debtor's board of directors that are controlled by Giant Eagle. That's at page B40. And the two lawsuits are the Delaware Chancery action and the Allegheny County action. To resolve the Horrible Group's objection to the disclosure statement, the bankruptcy court was required to determine which set of facts was correct. The facts in the disclosure statement, which Horrible contested, or the facts in the Delaware complaint, which he said were the true facts. Much of the evidence during the four-day confirmation hearing was directed towards this issue, and it also went to the heart of the Horrible Group's good faith claims. The court heard testimony from the board of Segrid, from representatives of Giant Eagle, counsel for Segrid, Mr. Horrible, who didn't appear for trial but was present by deposition, and others. To confirm the plan, the court also, as your honors know, had to make a finding of good faith under 1129A3. So faced with these allegations, the court ruled orally that Horrible's central claim that Giant Eagle had deliberately starved the company of capital was false. In the words of the court, quote, the debtor has also shown that in the months and years leading up to the bankruptcy filing, it pursued numerous alternatives available to it under the circumstances. The evidence presented details how the debtor engaged multiple investment bankers, and it goes on and describes the process. The court went on to hold, I note that stakeholders were offered an opportunity to participate pro rata in this investment. Mr. Horrible elected not to participate, which was certainly his right, but he cannot argue now that the plan's formulation lacked good faith. And that's in the record, page A24 through A26. So based on these factual findings, the court held that the plan was proposed in good faith. That's at page A372, and rejected plaintiff's allegations concerning the adequacy of the disclosure statement. That's at page A383.
May I ask you a question, Mr. McCoy?
Yes.
I'm assuming notice had to be given to Mr. Horrible and all the other creditors of the company, right?
Yes, that's the disclosure statement we're talking about.
Well, right, and part of the issue of that is to give them an opportunity to appear and object to the plan.
Correct.
If someone chooses not to appear and object to the plan, can they then argue later on that the good faith determinations, I mean, what is the law, that the good faith determinations were not necessary to the plan and that the entire capital structure of the newly reorganized company is up for grabs?
No, they obviously can. Now, what Mr. Horrible, I think, is trying to do is to say, well, good faith means two different things. Sometimes it means all the things leading up, putting you into the insolvency predicament, and sometimes it means, you know, actually proposing the plan, given that you are where you are.
But the plan has consequences here, as I understand.
Absolutely.
Has what claims against the new entity, and it does in fact establish the capital structure of the firm, both as an equity and debt basis, right?
It does, yes.
And your understanding is Mr. Horrible's collateral claims would seek to unsettle that and deprive Giant Eagle of the status it achieved under the plan, right?
That's my understanding. I mean, they might modify that and say, no, we don't want to take away any of their debt or anything.
Damage.
We just want a lot of money.
Right.
I assume that's what they would say. But it gets you to the same place. I mean, the point is that Giant Eagle was funding this company going forward. It was crystal clear where the claims were going to be. They were residing in New Segrid, and New Segrid was given the right to settle, dismiss, you know, there's a whole list of terms in the order, it was given the right to do any or all of those things. So it's very clear where the claims reside.
Mr. Nackmar, I'd like to ask a procedural question. This is out of order with your argument, but I'm not sure where you would come to it, so I apologize for that.
No problem, Your Honor.
Horrible was, when you were standing there before the Vice Chancellor arguing your motion to substitute, Horrible was objecting fairly strongly to him considering the collateral estoppel argument at that time, right? And you were only there that day on a motion to substitute. And at one point, and I'm reading from the appendices, at one point you even said, nor is the present motion the occasion to fully consider the collateral estoppel defense. And then by the time the hearing's over, the case has been dismissed. Did it come as a surprise to you that the case got dismissed that day?
It came as a bit of a surprise, to be candid.
Okay, I've read your brief, I'd like you to articulate for me the position that says that Horrible received adequate notice.
Sure.
That they were in danger of having their case dismissed that day.
Sure. So what happened was we filed a very simple motion to substitute, 7 pages, said the court order is clear, we should be substituted in. The other side filed a brief that was twice that length and said that would be terribly unfair because we wouldn't be able to have a day in court. We need to be able to present our claims. We replied by saying, among other things, what are you talking about? You already presented your claims. And the other side said, well, wait a minute. That's unfair. That's coming in a reply brief. We want the right to a sir reply. And we didn't oppose that. We said, well, that's fair. That, you know, sometimes things come up in litigation in ways that are, you know, you don't anticipate. We didn't anticipate them making the argument they did. We would have put that in the opening brief. But we said, fine, file a sir reply. We're not objecting. They filed an 18-page sir reply that joined issue on collateral estoppel. We then had an argument that joined issue on collateral estoppel, and the court ruled on collateral estoppel, as I think it's permitted under the law to do. And so I don't think there was any procedural unfairness. And by the way, in lieu of filing a reply brief, a sir reply brief, they could have said, well, wait a minute, we'd like to amend our complaint if that's what this is about. If the problem is that we're relying on facts that were already adjudicated, we got a whole bunch of different facts. Well, we'll amend and allege them. But they didn't do that.
And consistent with Justice Vaughn's question, is what you're saying is, it was a bit of a surprise, but that the Vice Chancellor was essentially, it was his application of Occam's razor to what you were doing.
Exactly.
Which is what you came before the court saying, substitute this because the plan blows them out as a plaintiff.
Exactly. Not only blows them out as a plaintiff, but no one can go forward with these claims in view of the findings of the court.
The next thing they're going to come back and say is the exact same thing, which is, oh, no, we get to litigate and say that we're a derivative plaintiff and blah, blah, blah. You have been coming in to say, these were assigned to us. We control the new thing. We get to do with it. We're going to dismiss it ourselves.
Not only are we going to dismiss it ourselves, but we're going to dismiss it ourselves because litigating these claims is a fool's errand. They've already been adjudicated, and collateral estoppel bars the assertion of these claims.
Right. And, you know, and in fairness, the people controlling new whatever were the subject of the claims. But you're saying, we went through this. As I read the Vice Chancellor, he said, you put in the collateral estoppel thing in your reply. He gives them a reply. He says, I know what's going to happen here. There's been litigation in prima, you know, in the potato sandwich territory, in the cheesesteak country, in bankruptcy court. I know we're going to have a next round of this. It's either collaterally estopped or it's not.
Correct.
And he finds that it's collaterally estopped.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And but like where you were going with seeking substitution was then to dismiss the case on your own and the case be gone.
Yes, I mean, that is almost certainly what would have happened.
Well, and you weren't going to form an SLC.
Right. The board was going to meet. They were going to get legal advice. The legal advice would read a lot like our collateral estoppel brief, I suspect. and they would have dismissed the case or declined to prosecute it based on that, and we'd be right back with the same arguments.
You're an excellent lawyer. I think part of his honor is why didn't you bring that motion, and was it okay for the vice chancellor to essentially, you know, grapple on this ground?
Well, we were doing it in steps, and we thought the shortest distance between two points was a bankruptcy order that said these are your claims, you can bring them. And then, yes, the next step would have been the challenge that we breached our fiduciary duties by not bringing those claims. And we would have been saying, but they've already been litigated unsuccessfully. Why would we bring them? Why would a corporation go and sue its directors or controlling stockholder or people with indemnification rights? Why would you do that when the claim has already – we had a four-day trial on these exact claims. That's – kind of the point.
Well, back to Justice Vaughn's question, you're satisfied under the record, although everybody walked into court initially on a motion to substitute, it turned into this motion to dismiss and collateral estoppel, but it only morphed into these other procedural postures after everybody knew what was going on and they had a chance to present evidence.
Absolutely. They had an 18-page brief on the collateral, surreply on the collateral estoppel, followed by argument on that issue.
But part of their brief was that they should be able to amend the complaint and that it should essentially be treated as a summary judgment motion, right?
But they never indicated how they would amend the complaint. And again, consistent with Rule 15AAA, litigants have a choice. When they're faced with something that says your complaint is deficient, it can't go forward, you can say, no, my complaint can go forward, or you can say, okay, I choose to amend. They could have amended at that point.
So I think the problem is that, you know, there was no 12B6 motion that would be subject to a 15AAA dismissal. And this was all, everybody walked in on a motion that just said we're substituting a party, and then, as Justice Vaughn pointed out, everybody walked out with a dismissal with prejudice. So all these 15AAA arguments are nice now, but that really wasn't on the radar at the time.
I understand that, but look, the bottom line is that if they have some new complaint that isn't barred by collateral estoppel, that wasn't litigated previously, they're free to bring it. I can't stop them. I wish I could, but I can't. But if it's the same facts, if it's based on the facts that have already been adjudicated, they have no business bringing that claim. That's where we are.
What did they say they wanted to do in their amendment?
They didn't. They just said they wanted to amend.
And they had the opportunity to amend before the hearing, too, right?
And they did. But the point is that they don't need the right to amend. If it's based on different facts, if the problem isn't that we starved them for capital, the real problem is we stole technology. I mean, there's no evidence that it never happened. But let's say that was their real problem. They could bring that claim. That's not foreclosed. The one that's foreclosed is the one that deals with the financing leading up to the bankruptcy. And that one was fully adjudicated. The good faith.
But if we go back to what you thought was going to happen. You went in on a motion to substitute. You thought you'd be substituted because it was now your case. You'd look at it, and you'd bring a motion to dismiss probably based on collateral estoppel. And it appears that the Court of Chancery saw where you were heading and said, okay, well, let's just do it all now.
Yes.
And that's what happened.
Yes. One minor correction. We wouldn't bring a motion based on collateral estoppel. We would bring a motion based upon...
Your report on why the case should be dismissed would be based
exactly
on collateral estoppel.
Correct. And so, you know, the other side says that these findings, the nub of their argument and what they focused in on today was the findings that the court made were not necessary to approve the bankruptcy plan, and they clearly were necessary for two reasons. One, the good faith of the plan of the bringing forward of the plan was clearly before the court. Now, the other side points out, well, there's law that says that the court may consider the pre-petition activities under the section of the Bankruptcy Code 1129A3, but it's not required to. But the cases also say that that's contextual. It depends what the plan objector is alleging. Here, the plan objector was alleging bad faith, not only in the 10 minutes, you know, prior to the plan being proposed and in the actual plan itself, but in the year and a half prior to the plan. So the court had to address those. If the court didn't address it, then they would have taken an appeal saying, we presented all this evidence, we had a 4-day trial. The court never even reached the critical issue. So the court had to do it. More important, the findings that the court made were absolutely essential to its approval of the disclosure statement. It could not have approved the disclosure statement if it believed plaintiff's version of the facts. And you know, they went to the court and they said there's this alternative universe of facts. It's set forth in the Chancery Court complaint. So they incorporated those very allegations by reference. The court adjudicated those allegations. The court found them to be lacking. It made specific fact findings. So unless your honors have any questions, I really don't have anything else I can say.
Thank you.
Thank you.